Hello and welcome to the Eat PhD Team podcast, the podcast here to help you with your relationship with food and body by giving you evidence-based techniques to support yourself with a sprinkling of feminism, a dash of dismantling diet culture and a side of vulnerability as we share our own messy lives with you. I'm Emilia, a registered nutritionist and PhD with the sole purpose of making your life happier and healthier. If you love it, please do go wild and share it. And if you're ready for support with our coaching, details are in the show notes. Hello and welcome to episode number 289 of the Eat PhD Team podcast with myself and Katie. Hi, Katie. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. I feel like it's been ages since I've been on a podcast, so I'm getting into the swing of it.
I know. I was thinking the exact same thing, and then I thought maybe that's just me being needy. So I'm very pleased that it's not just happy about that. How are you, Anna?
I'm good, thank you. All good. How are you?
I am good, thank you. I'm feeling like I've been through a bit of a rough patch, and I'm emerging out the other side. So I'm feeling good about that, and can't wait, because I was just saying to Katie before you came on, Anna, that my hair at the moment is just upsetting me. I'm going to get my hair done soon. I've booked that. It's just, do you know what? It's just a great time to be alive at the moment. You know, that's where I'm at. I did have one on those weekends, and I don't know if you guys get this, because I don't really, like, I get annoyed, I get irritable, I get pissed off, all these things, right? Like everyone does. But rarely do I feel like I'm in a bad mood. You know, when you're in a bad mood for no real reason, but you get in a bad mood. That doesn't really happen to me. And then, like, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, I was like, what is this feeling? For quite a few days, I was like, what is it? And I was doing a journal for the first time in ages, and I was reflecting, and I was like, I'm just in a bad mood. And it's been so long since I've had low mood in response to certain situations, but it's been so long where I've just not been like, there's nothing wrong. I'm just being miserable. I'm just being a miserable arse. So I'm coming out the other side of that, alas, acknowledging that I still have bad moods. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, because, and it's like, I talk about this all the time with clients, in that there is that, I think, particularly doing this sort of work, like you start to overanalyze and you're like, no, I'm just in a bad mood.
Yeah.
But don't you?
Yeah, I was going to say, it's like, I feel the same. I've actually been like the opposite. I've been in like a good mood and in a really good mood for the past few weeks. But there's also this part of me that's like in the back of my head, just like, oh, it's not going to last. It's not going to last. It's going to end soon. And then I'm like, no, I just need to enjoy being in the good mood.
Yeah, enjoy it. Because I think the more you obviously do like quote unquote positive psychology, and like the more and more you work on reframing and, you know, gratitude and all connection, all these things, you do have fewer bad mood days and you have many more good mood days. So then when you have a bad mood day, you're like, come on now, just come on. But yeah, you enjoy those good mood days. Feeling like minor.
I sat down to journal a couple of days ago, which I like is a practice that I'm just like not drawn to right now. And I literally was writing like, this coffee isn't very nice. I don't really like this milk. I was like, Katie, come on.
That makes me feel good selfishly, because that was the first time I journaled all year, and we're on the 4th of February, whenever it was. And I was like, I looked and I thought, where did I start this journal this year? And I was looking for it, and I was like, oh, I just haven't written anything all year so far. But it is funny, like, I think sometimes there's like this expectation that, especially us, because we talk about it all the time, that we do somatic work, yoga, meditation, journal, all of these things all the time. And like, I definitely, personally, I have favorites, where meditation for me is a favorite and yoga is a favorite, but journaling for me is really like, I really have to get to the point, at least at the moment, where I know that it needs to come out. Otherwise, I'm like, nah, that's fine. I definitely, whether I'm avoiding it or whether I'm just lazy, or I don't know, I'm like, nah. So that makes me feel better. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Okay, let's get started on the questions. Katie, do you want to go first?
All right. we go. A little bit of a longer one. So in your experiences, how common is it that healing your relationship with food is related to finding your voice and expressing your true self, thoughts and opinions? I'm finding that the more unable to express myself, the more I feel like I get to know myself a bit better, and the less empty I feel, and the less I feel I need to plug that emptiness with things like food. I'm only at the start of my journey, but already noticing I'm honoring things like my anger or sadness better, communicating more my opinions more directly to colleagues, etc. So basically, yeah, how related is healing your relationship with food to finding your voice and expressing yourself? And I'll jump in first. Like, I think that's like one of the biggest things that ETPHD is, we're like, it's so related. That's why we spend so much work with our clients, often like not talking about nutrition and not talking about food, because we kind of recognize that, you know, we all have needs and desires and emotions and wounds and all of the good and the bad, and that food is like one way that we've learned to cope, but that there are other ways to meet those needs. And so that's why we spend so much time working on that, exploring that, getting to know that, and finding other ways to meet those needs that doesn't have anything to do with food.
When you read out that question, I could see both me and Amelia were smiling, nodding along, like, yes, this is exactly what all of this work is about. And I think for maybe people listening who aren't in that place just yet, I think it's so important to keep that in mind, that at the moment, food or body or exercise or a combination of all three are likely taking up a lot of headspace right now. And that's kind of what you were saying, Katie, in through doing this work, it opens up all sorts of new possibilities. And like, our clients will know that, I think maybe even on that first page of like the welcome document, we say like, it's time to come home to yourself. It's not, or well, time to come home and find yourself again, find your true self.
Absolutely. It is emotional regulation. And when we think, and if you work with ADHD, you'll have heard the term emotional regulation, and it's kind of this umbrella term. And I think sometimes when people think of emotional regulation, they think of journaling, or they think of feeling their feelings or crying or ticking that box, and actually communicating your needs, voicing your opinions, understanding and communicating and holding people or situations to your boundaries is all part of emotional regulation. So they're so inextricably linked that, you know, ETPHD wouldn't exist if it was just about food. It wouldn't, like, it wouldn't be a thing. And, you know, we talk about food and your relationship with how you consider food, food neutrality, perfectionism, all of these things, but that's just one pillar of all of the work that we do at ETPHD. So yeah, inextricably linked. And also, thanks for letting me use the word inextricably, because what a great word that is, and I don't use it enough. So thanks. Anna.
So for reference, this client works in the fitness industry, does a lot of like pump classes, spin classes, that type of thing, like teaching, instructing. And she says, I have a week this week where I can actually fit in time to train myself. I know next week it will likely be detrimental to train with so much extra cover. How can I help the perfectionist in me accept this and feel excited to get back into training this week without feeling like I've failed next week?
Ooh. Do you know what? A writer that I love, she's called Chloe Gray, and she writes for various fitness wellness magazines, Stylist, I think maybe sometimes Women's Health. And I've done a lot of work with her in terms of like giving her stats or quotes or scientific opinions on certain things. And she wrote an article recently, I think it was Chloe anyway, wrote an article recently about how her relationship with food and exercise completely changed when she started being, and she didn't phrase it like this, but being fluid with exercise, and how she moved away from being thinking that she had to train X times a week and do this much cardio a week to focusing on like movement of some sort. So it includes, started to include things like yoga, running for enjoyment, training, resistance training was in there. And it was a lovely article, but it obviously just articulated what we talk about at ETPHD, where we often will talk about movement rather than exercise, because the healthiest relationship with exercise is movement that nourishes your body and feels good. It's wild that we've got to a place with fitness where we think that punishing ourselves by doing too much, or punishing ourselves because we've not ticked a box of like what evidence says is optimal for muscle protein synthesis and recovery, we punish ourselves for not doing that. Like, it's wild that that's norm, like that's been normalized. And I say this as someone who also used to do these exact both of these things. There's zero judgment. Like, it's, we've, a lot of us have been through it who are in the fitness industry, especially those of us who have careers in the fitness industry. I think this is not like a quick reframe, but a reframe in the moment of you're healing your relationship with exercise. We don't talk a lot about healing your relationship with exercise, which is a failure on ETPHD's part. Because that is a lot of the work that we do, is supporting you to heal this relationship where exercise, like I said, is punishment or burning off calories or something that you need to do because of hustle culture, because of that's what success looks like, whatever it may be. When the reframe that you're looking for is like, again, one, I'm healing my relationship with exercise, and two, I'm gifting my body with optimal movement or healthful movement. You doing more next week, as you know, is not the right thing. That would be unhealthful. So what you're doing is honoring your body. You're gifting your body with the quote unquote most healthful movement for your body. That to me, as a, if this person is a personal trainer or coach, is ultimate modeling for your clients. That to me, if I saw a coach who, say I worked in a gym still, right? And there was another personal trainer in there, and then she taught six classes that week. And then I saw her in the gym. I saw her going ham in those classes. And then I saw her on the same day in the gym five times that week. I would say to myself, I wouldn't make a judgment about that person, but I would say to myself, that person must be knackered. And then if I saw that same person saying, oh, you know what? I'm not training this week because I'm doing so many classes. But like, do you know, that to me is modeling such healthy behavior. You are a fantastic coach in doing that for your clients as well as doing it for yourself.
I mean, I think obviously, like you were saying, relationship with exercise is so important, but we know there is that pressure when you are working in the fitness industry. Like, if you were to think about a mum that couldn't train because her kids were sick at home, or someone that has a week of work that involves commuting that physically just doesn't have the time because sleep is probably more optimal to show up at work as they want to. Like, you wouldn't judge them, but there is that pressure that, well, because I'm a trainer, I need to be making sure that I'm keeping on top of my own training. And I think, like, thinking of, okay, well, if you were to, at what cost? Are you going to be showing up and delivering those classes as well as you want to? Likely not. Are you increasing risk of injury? Most likely. So I think considering that gentler week, not gentler work-wise, but gentler week in terms of your own training, as the most passionate, no, most compassionate thing that you can do for your body is so, so important.
Okay.
Nothing further to add to that.
Okay. Advice for supporting someone, supporting yourself, wait, advice for supporting yourself whilst supporting someone very close to you going through ADHD diagnosis. I find I can get very short-tempered and lash out and realize this isn't helpful.
I think this is the context that I know this in is like in my PhD research, when I did research with people living with dementia, and often like the carer, they're the person who really gets overlooked, you know, and it's a really difficult for them, and they feel like quite lost because a lot of the care emphasis is put on the person with dementia, and they don't get acknowledged for the amount that they're caring and the amount of like stress that they're under. So I share that not to necessarily come up with an answer, but just to say that it's a very normal human experience, even to feel the frustration and the anger. Like, that's very normal when someone close to you is going through that, and you feel like maybe they're going through the diagnosis, all the emphasis on them, there might not be as much space for your needs and your emotions to come through. And it's okay that sometimes you have to shelf them a little bit. I would just say this is where it comes back to, like, how are you being supported? Is it through, like, do you have access to therapy? Do you have like a friend or a loved one who you're sharing this with? Are you doing, like, do you have your own things, your own routines that you do, little things that you can do to care for yourself? Like, just asking the question of, like, okay, just because I'm in this sort of caring role, how am I being cared for? I would say that's the most important thing to start
I
with.
agree. I think having your own outlet is really, really important, so you're not invalidating your own feelings or suppressing them in any way. I also wonder if you could articulate this to the person next, the person going through this, not in a guilt or shaming way, but almost just like in a, this is where I'm at and I'm doing my best to support you. And because I think that these types of situations can often feel, you can leave you feeling quite resentful. And it's no one's fault that you feel resentful, but resentful when you're in any type of relationship with anyone that's close to you can be really damaging to your relationship in the short term, or if not the long term, if you don't articulate it. And that resentment comes from, you know, those unmet expectations or disappointment for things that you haven't articulated. And I wonder, depends on your relationship. And it's, again, it's not about saying, I'm struggling with you doing X, Y, and Z, or you taking up all the energy because you're going through this, etc. But more just, you know, this is how I'm feeling about these things at the moment. And I'm finding that what's coming up for me is X, Y, and Z. And it's not about you personally. I just need to find an outlet, and I'm going to have my therapist or my friend to have this outlet. But just keeping, if you can, a bit of an open line of communication, so you're not sat, you know, biting your tongue or rolling your eyes or getting resentful about, you know, the process. Because for them, you know, for people I've spoken to who have had ADHD diagnosis, this takes so long for some people to get an ADHD diagnosis. And I can't imagine how rough that is to go to wait for that diagnosis to come through. So they're going through a really tough time, and you're doing, the fact that you're asking this question, you know, means that you are supporting them as best you can. And what you don't want to do is to make yourself or them feel bad by letting resentment build up because you've got these unsaid expectations or unmet needs, that there may be other ways to meet those needs. That would be, I think, the only other thing I would say. Okay.
Right.
Katie.
The next question is, are there dietary or supplementary things someone with endometriosis can do to lessen inflammation or discomfort from flare-ups?
It sucks about endometriosis. What sucks about endometriosis is just that there's so much emphasis on PCOS into when it comes to women's health. And of course, women's health doesn't just include periods, PCOS, and endometriosis. There's a whole, you know, there's a myriad things that we can experience. But in fitness, for some reason, and I think it's because some of the key voices in fitness spoke about PCOS for a while, and then everyone jumped on it because that's where they got their source of information. And I think I'm probably one of those people that, you know, spoke about it a lot. And I try and include other things now because it can be quite invalidating. But one of the reasons why people don't talk much about endometriosis is because there isn't really any evidence to say this food or this supplement will help, which is quite dissimilar to PCOS, where we see some quite clear links between certain dietary patterns and supplement use, etc. With endometriosis, a lot of it is, it's an inflammation. It's a lot of the pain comes from inflammation. So when we're looking at dietary strategies day to day, most of the research is focused on like Mediterranean style dietary patterns, which I don't we don't propose like anti-inflammatory diets. It's not really a thing. And there are no quote unquote anti-inflammatory specific foods. You can't just take food in isolation and say, this does this. That's not how nutrition works. But you know what, with the people that I work with who have endometriosis, I will say, where possible, can you follow a dietary pattern that is high in fruits, vegetables, whole grains, fibers, relatively low in ultra processed foods, relatively higher in polyunsaturated fats. Be mindful of things like your caffeine intake, your alcohol intake, your intake of trans fats. These, and I would also say, like, if you're looking at polyunsaturated fat, make sure you're taking an omega-3 supplement. If you're not having 2 to 3 servings of oily fish a week, even if you're vegan and you think that you're getting it from tofu, the bioavailability of omega-3 is not optimal in these foods, so I would still supplement with some form of omega-3. And realistically, it's tough because it can obviously impact like your training. The pain can impact your training, and it can impact how you eat because you can feel stressed, emotional, anxious, and so working on your self-regulation is really, really important. There are little random little bits of evidence that are not robust enough for me to make a blanket statement. But again, when I'm working one-on-one with people, I will say things like, so cruciferous vegetables have a certain constituent in them that potentially could lower estrogen levels. And I'm talking minimal, to the point where your body wouldn't even probably notice. But if including cruciferous vegetables is an easy thing for you to do and you enjoy them, then let's include some of them more into your diet because why not? They're delicious, they fill you up, then they're rich in micronutrients. Great. There's a fatty acid in eggs and peanuts. It's a specific fatty acid that has some weird links in endometriosis. So again, I'm like, do you know what? If you like eggs and you like peanuts and on your yogurt bowls, then let's get some of them in. Not eggs on yogurt bowls, eggs separately, peanuts on yogurt bowls. Let's start including them along with some, you know, fresh fruit and vegetables where accessible for you. That's what I would recommend you focus on. I hate a lot of the narrative around endometriosis because it's things like cutting out food groups, similar to PCOS, cutting out food groups, cutting out like macros or specific food types, etc. And there's just no evidence for any of that sort of stuff. So that's where I would lie. That's where I land, rather.
Any recommendations for skin issues? My skin flares the week before my period, itchy eczema, small rashes. No doctor has been able to pinpoint it, but it definitely gets worse with PMS, stress, and processed foods.
I'm always mindful of making links between nutrition and skin because whenever I speak to an evidence-based dermatologist, they will say that the links are not there in terms of the evidence. We often go to food because it's the easiest thing to go to. So you're saying processed foods. How processed? What specific foods? Is it that, now I'm sure you don't do this, but is it that when you've got PMS, you eat pizza for a week, so you're not getting in, and you're not drinking enough water, and you're really not getting loads of fruits and vegetables in? Is it the pizza, or is it what it's replacing your diet? And again, the links between these things are quite tenuous, so I'm not saying eat more fruits and vegetables if you struggle with your skin. It's very, very, very common to have skin breakouts during PMS because of the hormonal fluctuations, and there isn't anything that you can do specifically to manage hormonal fluctuations. If you've got other symptoms of irregular periods, or you know, you really struggle with really bad PMS or pain, then that's something that you want to speak to your doctor about as a sort of side note, that your skin could be a manifestation of something going on there. But it's super normal to get especially breakouts with PMS, and that is not anything that needs to be pathologized. It's annoying. But I'm just very mindful, like, there's no link between specifically processed foods and skin. Similar to the link between like dairy and skin, there was like a meta-analysis that looked at that recently came out, I think, or in the last 5 years, that looked at like, I think it was teenage boys and dairy, and there was a slight link, and then everyone was like, oh, see, dairy is really bad for your skin, and it's like, it's just, again, it's not the evidence, and it's just develops these kind of orthorexic tendencies around food based on like things that are not necessarily linked. I don't know what the evidence is in
Yeah,
that.
I would just say like I really just want to pick up what you said, Amelia, about like just being careful not to pathologize something that is like normal. Like hormonal fluctuations are normal. And for some people, unfortunately, that manifests in skin breakouts. And yeah, there are things like topical treatments that you can use, and every skin is different, but yeah, just considering that point of view.
It's really side note entirely, but something that two things that I found really helpful for skin. One is, and I know Anna, you said this on the podcast before, but making sure you wash your pillowcases regularly, a classic. And the other is this, and this is not an evidence-based recommendation. This is me personally found it really useful because I get hormonal breakouts, is La Roche-Posay. There's like an, I think it's Efaclar, and it's like a little serum pot, and it's blemish control, and you just put a tiny bit on your blemishes. And I used to need that all the time because I used to get quite bad hormonal breakouts. This was probably like a year and a half ago, and then I started just to it die down a bit. But then I would start using it like in anticipation. So during PMS, I would just put it around the area of my mouth and my chin where I'd get hormonal breakouts. And now it's like if I get a breakout, I put it on topically just to that thing. And again, it's not evidence-based, but I personally, for me, I found it a really good product. So I know this person said it's not just about breakouts, it's about eczema and things too, and that eczema is something to speak to your doctor about annoyingly. Again, when we look at the research between nutrition and eczema, like, it's not there. A lot of parents will cut out dairy because in children there's some tenuous links between them. But as adults, those links are not there. So I'm just always mindful of that.
I can definitely relate to the I don't know about you guys, like when I'm quite stressed, which occasionally happens frequently. I get really, really itchy skin, and it's always like the same areas of my body, weirdly always my calves that are the worst. And similar to what you were saying, I mean, it maybe it's like, okay, well, if it is an area, can I use like a really nice cooling body lotion or like aloe gel, and just work on a bit of self-care in that.
This was just reminding me of something that I was looking at for EIQ. So I just Googled it. So this was 2 years ago now. And someone asked about eczema, atopic eczema, I call it eczema. And again, the evidence is like, try a Mediterranean style diet. Shockingly, like every single thing that we don't know what to say, we say Mediterranean style diet because it makes more sense. But right, there's one specific ingredient or one specific constituent of some foods. And some creams and oils called balsam of Peru. And apparently, it's one of the top five allergens in dermatologists' skin tests. And
Katie. I
I think it's found in
get
vanilla.
eczema, so I'm sorry.
Well,
My
yeah,
face, my
Google
jaw
it.
is like on the floor.
Vanilla, cinnamon, apparently it's there. There's different names for it in products, so you can Google it. Now, again, this was research I did 2 years ago. It's what take from that what you will. Again, we're not skin health experts by any means. Oh, it's me, isn't it? Let me just check if I'll get any on my own list. No, this is one for the other pod. Okay. I've been signed out of our list.
Oh
What a disaster.
no. Lynn's had enough of you messing up her
Yeah.
spreadsheet.
That wouldn't surprise me at all. Okay, we're on. We're on a back end lens. Suck it. I feel that I am really coming into my body and I am starting to hear what she wants. When I feel so much better in myself and have more headspace, why do I still have the urge to run back to a food plan and diet? At least once a week, I scour the internet and think of signing up for a new diet. I logically know that the work I am doing will ultimately free me, but the pull towards a plan is really strong.
I mean, because it feels safe, because it feels comfortable, because we like certainty, we like control, like the list goes on and on. But the fact that you can recognize that pull is awesome, because like you can see that majority of the week that it's not there and you feel really in tune with your body. So maybe I'm gonna say journal, but see, like, just reflect, like, are there any themes, are there any trends, is this pull happening at certain times throughout the week that you can just identify and go, okay, yeah, maybe that's a bit of a trigger that I'm kind of wanting to go back to what I know and what feels safe for me. Then is there something I can put in place to support me through that a little bit better?
Yeah, the only thing I would add there really is that food and body preoccupation often serve a purpose for us to stop us from thinking of other things. And sometimes when we free up the space that we've created, that we've previously filled with food thoughts, diet thoughts, body thoughts, we don't know how to fill it. What do we fill it with if we haven't really felt joy in ages, or we haven't allowed ourselves to do new things or to seek joy in things outside of food in our body? Maybe we actually realize that we're not necessarily fulfilled in our jobs because we go in 9 to 5 and then we don't want to think about it again, which, by the way, is absolutely fine. But maybe you're looking for more stimulation in regards to, like, mental stimulation. Maybe you're looking for more joy, or maybe it's uncovering things that you don't necessarily want to lean into right now. So maybe actually all of this energy being created is like, oh, well, actually, I feel a bit lonely, or I would like to feel something else. And you don't necessarily know what that is yet. And it's really, really scary to create space in your mind. It's why we all resist it. We all resist slowing down. We all resist meditation and yoga and somatic work, anything that allows us to slow down and actually let our minds be free. We're like, no, absolutely not, because what is it going to uncover? And the incredible thing about the work you've done so far is that you've created all of this energy, and your body just wants to go to, like, or your brain just wants to go to where it used to fill it, because that's what we were told to fill our energy with. That's what diet culture is. That is what diet culture is. It is encouraging predominantly women, people who identify as women, to put their energy into food in their bodies so they don't put them elsewhere. And what's amazing is that you're unpacking that now and you're like, oh, I'm taking it away from these things. Where can I put it? And diet culture is like, no, go back to food. Go back to meal plans. This is all you've known. Go back to that. It's totally, like you said, Anna, it's super, like, understandable. But you have the awareness so you can say it. Absolutely screw this, like, I have more to offer, or I want to just be, and I want to sit, and that's okay to just be, and develop that trust in yourself.
You know what's a really good somatic practice for that, like, because I think just pulling up what you said there, Amelia, about, like, it creates space. And, like, that's a scary place to be in, that all that spaciousness, but it's also, like, a really rich, rewarding place to be. And one of the things that you can, like, do to practice being in that sense of spaciousness is that, like, use your eyes, because, like, your visual system has, like, it's like the top of the hierarchy of, like, what your brain gets feedback from. And so that just this simple thing of, like, lifting the eyes from whatever you're focused on, scanning the eyes around your space, like, really mapping the whole space. We do it, like, when you're indoors, like, looking at all the walls up to the ceiling or out the window. And it's that intention of, like, just, like, spaciousness, like, reminding yourself, this is what it feels like to be embodying that sense of spaciousness. It's just, like, a really quick practice that I do with all of my clients at the beginning to get them used to that feeling of having all that space.
Yeah, I like that. I guess that a lot of people have experienced that just from being in nature or being somewhere vast where you do look up, you do look around you, and you don't necessarily, you're not necessarily aware that's what you're doing. But it's that same sort of, I would imagine it's that same sort of felt sense that you get versus, you know, sitting in your at your desk and doing that exact thing. Anna.
I know that everyone talks about all the positives they get from HA recovery in terms of confidence, life enjoyment, social benefits, but for me, I feel like it made my mental health a lot worse and I lost a lot of confidence and have less of a social life through gaining weight for HA recovery. I know there are benefits for my health, but I feel like I turn to comfort eating instead because of the loss of confidence. I'm now trying to regain that confidence, but I don't want it all to be dependent on weight loss, even though I do want to focus on weight loss. How else to regain confidence?
I think the key is in the question in that the feelings that you have are not because of HA recovery or because of your weight gain, which has restored your health, and that's incredible. And you're right that it's not necessarily going to change when you lose weight. The feelings are, or the confidence comes from the stories that you're telling yourself about this, which is amazing because these things we can change. And what we don't want is the stories that we tell ourselves about our body to be changeable based on our body size. I am worthier and happier when I'm leaner, which is the story that you've told yourself for so long, and understandably so. Thanks again, diet culture. Love you so much. But you've had this validated and externally like drummed into you for so long that you now are in a place where you genuinely believe that being in a smaller body is going to create this sense of like enoughness or improve your mental health. And you know, when we look at, if you look at the research into mental health, like yes, poor mental health or depression is linked with things like obesity and overweight, but not within a healthy BMI range. We don't see that link, and poorer mental health outcomes are associated with lower BMIs, like beyond the like the lower BMI ranges, beyond 18.5. So it's not a true story, but it's an understandable story that you've told yourself. And I know that it can feel invalidating me saying this because ultimately you are absolutely allowed to feel more confident in your body at whatever size you feel most confident in your body. And I just encourage you to challenge, like, why is that? Why is it that you feel more confident in your body in a smaller size, which potentially is detrimental to your health? It's unlikely that it's because that's where you physiologically feel best, because you don't have a cycle, you have an irregular cycle. So physiologically that just doesn't align. So it's something else. So I would really encourage you to look at the people that you follow on social media, the type of stories, the type of books that you read, just what you look at and internalize as quote unquote normal or healthy. Because genuinely, like I saw an article the other day actually about how body positivity as a hashtag is massively declined. People don't use it anymore. It seems to be a trend that's disappearing. And it didn't really surprise me because I think it got blasphemized and all of these other things. Anyway, for me, I don't follow people on social media, one, for their bodies. Two, I don't really follow anyone really that shares a lot of their body. There's probably some like sex positive accounts that I follow that do, and maybe some lingering competitors and stuff that do, but I don't really. And I follow people with a huge diverse range, like a really diverse range of bodies and lifestyles and content. And I even that as a standalone, thinking about realistically what's the most media that you consume, it is probably going to be your social media accounts. Like look at what you follow. Like when I look at people who are confident on social media, it's not really much to do with their bodies. But a lot of the people that I find who do appear outwardly the most confident appear are people who tend to be in like the like slightly larger bodies in some way. I think that the narratives that you consume are so crucially important, and we talk about it all the time. But I think people are probably like, oh yeah, unfollow people that don't feel make you feel good, blah blah blah. Genuinely. Look at your timeline, like look at your algorithm. I'm never going to feel good following, you know, really lean people with ginormous boobs and flourishing relationships and loads of money and also really mindful and all like that's probably never going to make me feel that great. So I probably won't follow it. And I think that we have to take a bit more, put a bit more emphasis on that.
Follow more female athletes. Like, what a diverse range of bodies in female athletes. And it's
Yes.
incredible what they do.
I was going to say, kind
Okay.
of practically speaking, at the moment, actions and behaviors are reaffirming that belief. Well, because I'm in this body, I'm not confident, so I'm not going to show up. I'm going to stay at home. I'm going to comfort eat to help my feelings. And obviously, we're working through all of this, but I would say now is the time that you really have to start challenging that belief and kind of get curious and go, okay, well, what if I show up as I am? Oh, nobody thinks anything less of me. Great. Okay, fantastic. What if I show up as I am and have a great time? And like, it's just about building that belief that the body that you're in right now is, as you were saying, Amelia, just as worthy, but you can still do all of the things that maybe you've been stopping yourself from doing up until this point.
Yeah, even something as simple as like say simple, like having sex and dating as an example, right? Whether it's you're in a relationship or not, I wonder how much you hold yourself back from doing those things because of your body, not feeling confident in your body. And actually, most women will know, well, in my experience, when you have sex is generally when you feel most confident after you've had sex, or like you are happy you're starting a new relationship, or you're just connected to your partner. That's often when you feel the most at home in your body and confident and connected. And you might be avoiding those things because you don't feel confident. And sometimes, just like with business or anything in your career, you often do the things, you often have to do things before you feel confident in doing them. Okay.
All
How do
right.
you, oh, how do you commit to the small as opposed to like jump in head first into everything and wanting to change everything all at
Yeah.
once?
This is my client, and we've been like doing work, but she really struggles with that all or nothing mindset. So it's like when she signs up to something, she's like, right, I'm all in. I want to do it 100%. I want to go from not working out to working out 6 days a week and make all these big drastic dietary changes. So like that some of the work that we've been doing is just it's a combination of like we're doing that work of like realizing where the perfectionist mindset is coming from, and what kind of needs are being met by having that perceived control over things. But the other thing that we're doing is like we're just setting these really like we're setting these goals, and we're just bringing this intention of like curiosity to it, and almost that like it's fun. It seems hilarious that we're going to set like rather than working out 5 days a week, like we're only going to set these like 10-minute workouts, and it's going to be like you have to stop, and like she'll laugh and she'll be like, that seems like so incredibly easy. I'm like, yeah, that's the point. And like so sometimes I know it's a really a bit of a non-answer, but like the way to challenge the small is like if use structure to your advantage. Use these like set these incredibly easy goals and prove to yourself that you can do it. Like be like, okay, for a week, I'm just gonna rather than going 100% on this change, I'm gonna go 10%. This is what 10% looks like in a practical sense. And like, let me just do it for 1 week and see what happens.
It's building that kind of like the first question, building that more flexible mindset to towards things in that it doesn't need to be 100% all of the time. And kind of similar to what you were saying, Katie, I'm sharing a client win who over the past, well, we're in February now, so over the past what 6 weeks has been practicing imperfect action with movement side of things, and just kind of because it would be the case that if you couldn't do 30 minutes, then there was no point in doing it. Whereas also challenging how long a session could be and what that type of movement might be, and being more intentional with stretching and yoga and all of the other things that support her resistance training. And this week she had her first appointment of the year with, I think it's a chiropractor, I want to say, who couldn't believe the difference in her posture because she'd actually been consistent with all of the movement side of things. I won't share exactly what they said because there were expletives with the difference in posture, but it just goes to show that focusing on the small and being consistent with those like has huge, huge benefits.
This is probably on a bit of a wider scale, but I think it kind of ties in a little bit to like this. I guess it's a bit of a hustle culture narrative of like the big things are the big things in life are the most important. So like the big job, the job promotion, or the certain amount of money in the bank, or the qualification that you get, or like the overall amount of body fat you lose, or whatever this outcome thing is. And we think that these are the most important parts of our life, or the house that we buy, or whatever. And really, the most important parts of your life are the small bits, like the moment that you baked a cake with your niece, or the moment that you and your partner sat on the house of your new house, sat on the floor of your new house, and had takeaway pizza because you didn't have a sofa yet. Or like it's the little moments that you slow down and connect with someone, or connect with yourself, or like those are what those little moments are, what life is, not these big massive things. And I think that if you can get your head around that, you start to appreciate all of the little small parts of things that make up like your like that make up your life, and I think make up the most important parts of your life. And the big things are great, but they, you know, they're not what life is, in my opinion. So it's kind of more holistic view of this question. It doesn't necessarily answer the question, but I think it ties in. Okay, let's leave it there.
Is it me?
No, oh, we've got a bit
Oh,
of delay on
perfect.
Kitty.
All right.
Thank you all for your questions. Thank you both so much. Bye.
Thanks.
Bye.
Thanks so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. And as always, if you did, please do feel free to like, share, subscribe, and review. And if you would like to chat to me, then you can find details of my Instagram in the show notes.